Hello, and welcome back to Slut PhD. This episode's topic is going to be about why young men in developed countries are drifting so far to the right politically. Obviously, it was motivated by the most recent election results here in America, but this issue is popping up all over developed countries, and chances are, if you're listening to this podcast and you speak English as either your first or primary secondary language, the types of issues that we'll be talking about tonight likely affect you. This is going to be a conversation with my husband, Johnny Walker, who is seriously considering trying to launch some sort of YouTube channel in reference to all of this. He's raising his eyebrow at me skeptically. But we've been talking about this a fair bit between us. He's always been my sounding board for better understanding the sociological position of cis men. We've been together since we were 18 years old, so if we sound like the kinds of crazy people who just finish each other's sentences, it's because we are. But he's really actually done a great deal for me in terms of my ability to understand the social position of cis men, and I feel like, ironically, cis het men are a staggeringly under-researched and under-theorized category in general, both in sociology and gender studies and throughout the related disciplines. I want to give a lot of trigger warnings for this episode. It's going to be brief talk about suicide, homicide, drug overdose, touching on sexual assault and domestic violence. So, good times. I promise my next episode will be a little bit more jolly than this one. I was originally thinking my next episode was going to be about my research on the porn industry, and then I realized that was even grimmer than this. So, I figure I'll do something else next time. But do we want to introduce yourself briefly?
Hi, I'm Johnny. I'm married to Julie. I have a Bachelor of Science in Computer Science and no other relevant credentials.
You are a man.
I am a cishet man. I can speak to a limited degree about the experience of cishet men.
Oh, also relevant to say that we're both in our early 40s, and so most of the rise in conservatism among young men has actually been for men ages 18 to 29. So this is technically outside of your experience.
Yeah, this is going to be more of a compare and contrast thing more than a, hi, this is what is happening to people exactly like me.
And they definitely seem to be following along trend lines from when you were younger. It doesn't seem like this has come out of the blue.
No.
And so I don't think that it's a huge leap for you to be able to generalize from your own experience and maybe provide some perspective that some younger people don't have yet. So for our opening question, I wanted to talk about how the phrase not all men emerged. And
oh God.
What does it mean, and like, why is it so controversial?
So not all men emerged largely in response to like the Me Too movement, where there was in addition to people like posting their stories about like, yeah, this happened to me too, sort of an undercurrent that rose up with that was a lot of animosity towards men, sort of a generalization of the anger at sexual aggressors and sexual predators, sort of generalized to people who looked like them, other men. And then the sort of a backlash against that hashtag not all men, where people felt the need to speak up when they felt like they were being lumped in with the sexual predators.
Yeah. So it became increasingly controversial, I think, because a lot of people, especially women, were like, if you say not all men, then that means you're just not understanding the nature of the problem. And then this was also many men arguing back, well, maybe you're not understanding the nature of the problem. And it kind of started to turn into what felt like a little bit of a war of the sexes, right? Where there's a bunch of women saying there's all of these power inequalities that are built into society and deeply structured in, and this is why men are able to take advantage of women sexually, and why women end up feeling predated upon, even when maybe in that same and nearly identical situation, a man wouldn't necessarily feel that way. And men responding with, no, it's just some bad apples. And I think the sense of it's just some bad apples was something that many people really resented of saying, well, no, this is structural. And, you know, in your life, and this was something that came up a lot in these conversations, you've benefited as a man from these structures. So now we've taken away your ability to comment on or criticize anything else. I feel like a lot of times these conversations became very counterproductive and lots of cutting one another off and not really seeing things from both sides. And the reality oftentimes was that this was complicated.
Well, another aspect of that and of the whole not all men discussion, it was men who opposed gender inequality, who opposed sexual predation, who understood the existence of rape culture, as it gets phrased, and the structural inequalities that allow men to predate, prey on women, who were there to, like, you know, there for that fight and were wanting to just sort of dismantle those power structures, wanting to be able to say, hi, I'm with you, I'm not with them, and being shouted down saying, no, you are one of them.
Right, which is so counterproductive to the conversations, right? Like, I feel like it's just a lot of people not hearing one another. And that was some of what motivated me to write the book, Violated Sexual Consent and Assault, which was published just a few months ago. I'll do a whole series of episodes on that book. But in general, I feel like the Me Too movement, a number of commentators have really pointed to that. So this was 2017, for those of you who are very young and listening to this, in 2017, that really seems to have been a linchpin moment. Again, that showed up in developed countries, not just the United States. Also was severely taken over by Russian trolls, right? So, like, there was a lot that got really messy in terms of the social and political social media of that. And a number of the commentators I was looking at when I was doing research for this episode were suggesting that that was kind of the linchpin moment that gave rise to these young men's hostility online. But I mean, certainly the patterns, I think, were there long before.
Oh, a lot of those patterns were there long before. I mean, the you choose the phrase war of the sexes, which was coined well before.
Yeah, but I mean, it kind of had a different feeling back then.
Maybe it did to you.
Fair enough. You know, I think another thing that you've complained about is that you say that cishet straight men often end up feeling like they have to apologize for existing in lefty spaces and or distance themselves from their identities in order to be accepted in them.
Right. So, like, I exist in a lot of left-wing, very liberal spaces, and I am often, in a lot of those spaces, the token straight guy.
You have an identical twin brother who's gay.
Yes.
So you've always been a little bit of a weirdo in that sense.
Always been a little bit of a weirdo in that sense. Like, at a gathering that I will not name, I had people set me down and loudly declare me to be an honorary queer just so I could, they could basically declare me to be one of the group, because I couldn't be if I was de facto straight, yeah. Essentially. And, like, on the one hand, then sort of, like, you know, declaring you are one of us felt very nice and very
inclusive.
On the other hand, there is a degree to which it was just like, yeah, we're doing this because on some level, you, with just your obvious labels as they are, it sort of at least felt like that. The reason they were doing it was that you, with your labels as they are in some sense not quite right. Not quite good, right for this space.
Not one of us.
Not one of us.
Not one of us. And I think you've also said that you feel like frequently liberal spaces end up feeling like men as a class are the enemy.
That's more about, like, liberal discourse than liberal spaces. So, like, when you're talking about, like, politics, everything wants to get reduced to a soundbite. Everything wants to be short and pithy. And often political debate is the death of nuance.
Yes.
But I think there needs to be some, because to the degree that on the left, and I'm including men on the left here, who are engaging in political discourse, especially on social media, especially in places where tone is absent, doing this thing where they belittle or demonize nearly half of the population, that they are doing themselves a disservice just from a purely political and pragmatic point of view. Like, let's set aside for the moment that it makes people feel bad for their gender, which is a bad thing. Just from a purely pragmatic point of view, if all the lefties are posting things to their social media, and this is a trend I saw for a while, it was just men are trash, like young men or boys who haven't sort of gelled on their position on politics yet are going to see that. And they're going to see that, oh, these are the people on the left. There's no place there for me.
Yeah.
They are against me. They have declared me to be their enemy. So I guess I am.
Yeah. And it's really counterproductive to having any sort of helpful conversation with people at the point where it just becomes acceptable to say, oh, your group is bad. Also, it seems staggeringly naive for women to be saying, oh, men have hurt us so much. And for them to not understand that actually men hurt other men a lot. And I'm going to get to that here in just a moment.
Oh, yeah.
But I think the takeaway that I would love for you to come away with from this episode, if you're like, no, I just don't feel like listening to the rest of this, is that, you know, when liberals don't support men's feelings of isolation and exclusion and address concrete gendered issues that men face, then men end up seeking comfort and solutions elsewhere. And for the time being, the right has been the ones offering. And that's true across developed countries. That it's like the conservative people are the ones to be the shoulder to cry on for the way that men have suffered from very real disadvantages in our society, that for whatever reason, for a variety of reasons, liberals have been very resistant to hearing, understanding, or appreciating.
And it's also worth noting that just saying, oh, but they're not offering real solutions, their solutions are insane or awful or immoral, and they are, doesn't do any good in terms of the pragmatics of politics when you're talking about the fact that they're swaying young people who haven't decided their ideology yet, who are still influenceable, still malleable, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, there's a really simple and important reason why the military for many years has always preferred very strongly to recruit men between the ages of 18 and 23, and that is that they're impressionable and easy to convince that they should go kill people when told to. And the military, while they will reluctantly accept young men who are older than that, when a draft comes in, many interviews from the military say, oh, well, you know, we take them when they're older when we have to, but we'll never be able to make nearly as good of soldiers out of them if we get them when they're older, because they're just not so malleable. Well, gosh, that seems like it would be a point that we should take to heart in other aspects of our society.
Right. And it's also worth noting that people at that younger age are way more dominated by their emotions in the moment. This is not a slam on those people. It's just you've got less background to draw from, less experience to lean on, less formal education, less resources, less of anything to draw on other than your emotions to deal with. And emotional appeals and emotional faux pas land harder.
So let's talk about some of these disadvantages that I feel like so many people that I try to have these conversations with seem to doubt. I'm going to put a link to a book that was published, I believe, in 2022 by Richard Reeves called Of Boys and Men. He's associated with the Brookings Institute. He really goes through a lot of these things point by point in there. And I encourage you to look into the book if this is all very new to you. We're going to hit some of the highlights in this episode. And I think perhaps this is the most important point in some ways. If we're talking about this, I'm going to try to really unpack what's going on here with this drift to the right among young men. You see that across developed countries, boys do much worse in school than girls. And this is a pretty recent trend. This is something that's only happened since the late earlies and the early 90s. I was reading even authors of some of those studies talking about, oh, in the 1970s, like in my high school class, you know, all of the top achievers were boys. And like by the late 90s, you know, 70% of valedictorians and salutatorians in the United States, which are the top two graduating students in the class, were girls. And this really matters a lot. 41% of women with bachelor's degrees versus 32% for men in 2020 in the United States. So we're talking about big education gaps here, and in the United States in particular, but I mean, I think across developed countries in general, education is strongly associated with political orientation and knowledge and background. And there's the best guess difference of 6% difference for on-time high school graduation rates favoring girls, meaning 6% more girls graduate high school on time than boys. 51% of girls graduating high school with a GPA of 3.0 or higher. And for those of you listening internationally, the scale there goes 0 to 4. Generally, you can't graduate, I think, if you have a GPA lower than 2.
Yeah.
So, you know, 51% of girls graduating high school with a GPA of 3.0 or higher, but only 36% of boys doing so. That's a huge gap. And in the United States, this gender gap holds and across all racial groups. It looks slightly different, but you see it across all racial groups. And then a recent study that I saw that I'm really hoping to get the author of to interview on this podcast, because like, this research is amazing. We're saying that gender gets really weird on this one, that more feminine gendered boys actually do quite well in school, while more masculine gendered girls do badly. And this actually has some really interesting implications for queers. So he was specifically looking at like gay boys and lesbian girls. So this was a long time ago, so like 2009 in high school. And he pointed out in the presentation I saw that gay men are actually the most educated country in the world in the United States if they were their own country. Gay men are extremely well educated in contrast to heterosexual men. And so like if you subtracted gay men's profound educational achievements out of this equation, actually this gap of education between men and women would look even worse. But lesbians actually do worse in terms of educational achievement than straight women, but it's not quite so severe. But I thought that we'd try to get some qualitative color in this by talking to Johnny about some of his experiences in school. And I want to back up a little bit here by saying that, you know, you didn't graduate top of your class. You did fine.
Like you know, B to C average in high school.
You went to college. You graduated college.
Went to college. Graduated. I did much better in college than I did in high school. I was also in a comp sci field, and all of those statistics you're talking about hold true through college when we were accepting fields that are heavily dominated by men, like engineering and computer science.
Yes.
So I got the gender advantage in computer science.
Well, you started out in nursing and
I dropped out.
Yeah, you dropped out because of the gender discrimination.
I dropped out because trying to maintain the nursing program and a job on top of major depression meant I collapsed at work.
Yeah, also.
Also the gender discrimination.
Gender discrimination.
It was pretty crappy.
It was really bad. You were one of what, like three guys?
I was one of three guys.
Yeah.
Like there were formal questions on the exams that were like, if you're a male nurse, your job is to do more physical work or take more physical risks than the female nurses. So like, one of the questions was like, assuming you were a female nurse, what do you do if you have to lift a heavy patient or deal with a violent patient and there's not a male nurse to assist?
By the way, there's a literature on this called the glass escalator that's about men in female dominated professions and how like they often get sort of looked down on and yet paid more. So male nurses are actually
at least they were when I was in school,
they were paid more on the assumption that they were going to be doing heavy lifting. But let's talk about more about your primary school experience in terms of like what made that hard, what you think affected your academic achievement there.
Well, I went to a specific set of not well-funded rural schools in rural North Carolina, so I can only speak to that experience.
You grew up as a quarter Asian, three-quarter white passing.
I mean, you say white passing, I'm not passing by appearance, but also it's a small town, so everyone knows who your grandma is.
That's fair. So white passing by appearance, you grew up in a very working class.
A very working class school.
Very, very predominantly white, very predominantly white, rural working class school.
So like things that were like really rough and challenging for me in that was, I mean, aside from the undiagnosed major depression and autism and undiagnosed EDS, was the constant gender and sexuality policing. Like it was just constant overt and overblown performance of masculinity that you have to engage in order to not be thought of as gay, or a sissy. And if you're thought of as one of those things, chances are someone's going to beat the crap out of you because you have then become part of the target class. So you know, to go with that, sort of a constant low to mid-grade threat of physical violence, not necessarily a dangerous to life and limb sort of way, because like I don't know many people that were ever seriously injured other beyond like maybe a broken finger in one of those altercations, but it was still there, and it was still this thing that you were constantly dodging, constantly navigating. Also, you know, talking about like the, you know, the guys being part of the problem for guys. When I was in school, at least, the way that guys used teasing and violence as much as a form of affection, as a form of disapproval, was seriously fucked up and did not do great things for my mental health, I have to say. And it really screws with your ability to, you know, concentrate on trying to remember Newton's third laws, or when the Emancipation Declaration was signed, or whatever other piece of trivia that you need to learn in order to score well on a test this week. And if I sound very dismissive of the education that I received in high school, there is a reason for that.
Sure, but, you know, I mean, some people from your high school went on to do quite well, but the people who went on to do very well from your high school were mostly...
There were women, and also women. I think those women succeeded despite that school, not because of it.
I mean, sure, but it's not exactly common that that like a white working class rural high school would have produced like a best selling author and like numerous people from your high school.
Yeah, they've done
quite well, which is not standard.
It's not. It's very weird. But also, everyone who's done really well from my school is a woman. There are no huge success stories of any guys from my school. We don't do that. Mostly we just do drugs.
Yeah.
That's what most of the guys from my high school are doing right now, is drugs.
We're gonna get there in about 2 seconds. So the next thing down on my list here to talk about in terms of disadvantages for men is grim differences in life expectancy, which somehow our society has always waved off, because these have been true for a long time. This is not new.
It's very common to just sort of attribute it to a combination of men doing more dangerous jobs, as if that's not a gender inequity that needs to be addressed, and men being stupid and doing reckless things and getting themselves killed.
It's important to note in this context, however, that the life expectancy difference between men and women used to be pretty high. And I think a lot of it did, in fact, used to come from that. It got a lot narrower for a little while, and now it's widened again. Although, if we're talking about life expectancy, the U.S. remains a terrifying aberration among not even very rich countries, actually. U.S. life expectancy right now is terrible. I could do a whole episode on it. I went to a whole conference about it recently, but women live 5 to 7 years longer than men, and in demography, the classic sociological aphorism was women get sicker and men get deader, because as you see, especially advanced ages, like women are much more likely to experience various types of disability and chronic illness, but men are just more likely to die. Men are also much more likely to be the victims of homicide in the U.S. They used to be more likely to be the victims of violent crime in general, which you never would have known from the way that men and women were socialized. But that seems to have evened out, or maybe switched up just a little bit. But still, 79% of U.S. homicide victims in 2023 were men. Homicide victims in the United States are disproportionately Black men, specifically. But this statistic, in essence, has been true pretty much my entire life. And it's always fascinated me that, especially in conversations with women on the left, that they'll tell men pretty dismissively, you don't understand what it is to be so afraid. Walking down the street as a woman, you're just always afraid of like what a stranger might do to you. And for most of my life growing up, that just didn't make any sense. Like, functionally, it was a form of social control, because men were much more likely to be the victims of violent crime, and particularly much more likely to be the victims of stranger violent crime growing up in the United States. I could say it's evened out a bit more now. Ironically, as a bisexual woman, I'm extremely likely to be the victim of a stranger violent crime, which I only relatively recently learned. But that's not exactly part of our teaching, right? Like, usually a lot of gender socialization really focuses on the idea of, as a woman, you might get sexually assaulted. And in point of fact, sexual assault by strangers towards women is incredibly rare, far more rare than you were ever led to believe. And the people who are most likely to hurt you are boyfriends, male partners, stepfathers, fathers. Like, these are the people who actually pose a threat to you. But ironically, you aren't really taught to fear those people, which I think is super bizarre. But regardless, you know, it has become one of my major points of talking back to people when they tell me things like, oh, as a man, you don't understand what it's like to be afraid. It's like, well, that's because men aren't socialized to be afraid, but that doesn't mean that they aren't at risk of all kinds of violent victimization.
I think this is also, in a lot of ways, heavily related to the cultural idea that violence against a woman is just more abhorrent than violence against a man.
Yeah.
In many ways, we view the safety of men in terms of violence, at least, to be less important than the safety of women, because it's supposed to be. And this is, I think, in many ways intentional, because it's like it's hard to convince men to join the military if they're convinced they're supposed to be safe.
Their lives are supposed to be precious. Yeah. And related to that, men don't, I think, find their own lives to be as precious. Men are much more likely to actually kill themselves than women. I've seen statistics saying women are much more likely to try, but men are much more likely to kill themselves, and they're also much more likely to die of a drug overdose. For conservatively calculated suicides, which I'm not going to get into all of the ramifications of that, men make up 80% of suicides in the U.S., and their suicide rate is 4 times that of women. But interestingly, for young people who are focused here, they're actually the group who are least likely to kill themselves, which did not used to be the case long ago. But they are no longer the people who are the most likely to kill themselves, actually the least likely. But in general, approximately 70% of what have been deemed deaths of despair, which are it's a combination of like suicide, drug overdose, alcohol, cirrhosis, I think, and possibly, depending on who's doing the tallying, I think tobacco-related deaths.
Yeah, I feel like rolling tobacco in there is probably a reach a little bit.
Yeah, it depends on the social context. I'm not sure. And I'm not, yeah, obviously, if we're talking about Germany, that wouldn't make sense there. But in America, it's more reasonable. But anyway, so when we talk about deaths of despair, frequently they'll also exclude actual deaths labeled as suicide. Regardless, about 70% of deaths of despair, however you calculate them, are men. And it's also worth noting, in the U.S. context at least, that suicides and deaths of despair disproportionately affect Indigenous and non-Hispanic white men. So like, this is very racially separate in the United States. And minority effects in general affect suicide rates in whatever country context you're looking at. So yeah, guys kill themselves a lot, and they kill each other a lot.
Yeah.
And that's really the theme here.
It is. And it's something that, as a society, that we just tend to sort of either ignore or accept. I'm not sure which.
Yeah, I think we just are like, well, men are violent. Huh. Like, okay, but shouldn't we do something about that?
Part of the problem when we're going over these ideas that I keep running into is that on the left, we've done a decent job at putting some big cracks into the structure of patriarchy and dismantling some of the apparatus of patriarchy. But we haven't done a good job of replacing those with anything more useful and more egalitarian. And part of what we have failed to do is to cultivate a concept of masculinity that isn't encumbered with the predisposition to violence as an aspect of masculinity, or frankly, just the idea that men are more conservative as an aspect of masculinity. And we also haven't done a lot to cultivate the acceptance of gender nonconforming men to the degree that we have for women.
I have an entire episode that I'm going to do in a couple of weeks on that, interviewing one of my friends. Absolutely.
So, like, if a woman's wearing quote-unquote men's clothes, even if they're, like, not just pants and jeans, whatever, but, like, off the men's rack, we barely bat an eye. A guy going out in a dress to this day is still a little risky.
Yeah. Yep, for sure. Yeah, really.
And I should also say that in a lot of ways, the expression of gender for men overall is just a little narrower than it is for women.
I think it's a lot narrower.
You're the sociologist. I will defer to you on this.
I'm going
to
say it's a lot narrower. Another one of the trends that seems to be affecting men, and especially young men's experience, is that young people are dating and having a lot less sex than they used to. I found that more and more people are starting to become aware of this, but it still tends to shock people because we have this hilarious idea that what you see on Netflix TV shows is a reflection of reality, even though most of those shows are written by people who are about my age and older, about teenagers nowadays, and they don't know shit about what kids are actually doing these days. But in reality, there's a lot less sex happening among teenagers. The unfortunate truth is that less dating socialization has much worse social and psychological effects on men than women, because men's non-romantic social networks tend to be pretty emotionally shallow. So there's a well-documented sociological literature that talks about how when boys get into their first romantic relationships with girls, and this is focusing on straight boys, when straight boys get into their first relationships with girls, it's often literally, they'll talk about in interviews, the first time in their lives that they've gotten to seriously talk about their emotions with someone before, with a peer. And it's not novel for girls. And so those first relationships just don't have the same effect on girls that they do on boys, because girls have often been having these kinds of deep emotional relationships with other girls for years. But for boys, it's really quite novel and has a huge impact on their life and their social development. So to see young people dating less, you'd expect to see, and it's what's happening, that boys are going to experience much worse psychological outcomes from that than girls. And you see, and related to these trends, that it's also just numerically affecting them differently. So one of the numbers I found was that if you're looking again at this age range of like 18 to 29, like 63% of young men report being single compared to 34% of young women, which is a fascinating statistic. No one bothered to break that out, but I had so many questions. I cannot verify that. It's not my number. In general, we're seeing massive declines in reports of all forms of sexual interactions for young people. So when people were first seeing this decline in sex, a lot of people were attributing it to porn and saying, oh, you know, people, especially boys, are spending so much time watching porn. They get these ideas that this is how sex is supposed to work. And then, you know, real life humans just can never match up. Well, it turns out that's not remotely what's happening, actually. For a long time, we thought that was what was going on, but subsequent research has shown that it's not what's going on at all. In fact, solo masturbation has also massively declined for young people. And at least one analysis I found of the porn watching was that it's only the teens who are, or the young people who are watching porn having sex. The ones who aren't having sex aren't watching porn. So there's like this big divide here that was not at all what people had assumed that it was. I would say there's a big divide. So it's highly correlated with having more sex and watching porn. Another thing that's worth noting, I'm doing a bunch of research on, maybe I'll do a podcast, another episode about this. Young women are also identifying as bisexual at higher and higher rates. And when I say higher and higher rates, I mean, we're talking like 20% of young women in this age range versus like 5 to 7 for men. So young women are identifying as bisexual at higher and higher rates, and young men are too, but not nearly as high. And it's possible that's driving a wide gap here in terms of the dating ratio, right? Who's available? It's possible, I doubt it, that most of that huge difference about single men versus single women could just all be women dating each other. I don't think that's what's going on. But based on the numbers, it's not out of the realm of possibility. So it's certainly worth recognizing that when you hear young men complaining about how, like, they aren't having sex and they aren't dating, a lot of times we tend as a culture to be really dismissive of that. Like, oh, you're just so entitled. You think women are supposed to fuck you. Like, that's not how it works. You have to earn it. And that's all true. But the reality is, the harsh reality, that men really lose something when they are not dating and in relationships with women, and women often don't lose nearly as much when they're not dating and in relationships with men. And there's a whole set of reasons for why that is, in terms of the sociological setup of emotions and friendship dynamics. So I wanted to talk to Johnny a little bit to add, again, some color to these statistics. You know, obviously, again, we grew up in a different era. There was a lot more sex going on when we were kids. There was not the same kind of obsession of social media. But I just wanted you to talk a little bit about your social networks with other straight men when you were in high school and early college.
So my social network with other straight men in high school, especially we're narrowing down to straight men,
yeah,
because my twin brother is gay, was actually pretty sparse. There was a handful of guys I hung out with. We managed to maintain some level of contact through my first 2 years of community college, and basically that completely fell apart when I went to a four-year university. Just being physically further away, despite the existence of phones and the internet at the time, were insufficient for me to be able to maintain any sort of social contact with them. I was never emotionally intimate, did the whole sharing feelings things with any of those guys, because that was not within the social script or the social context. And in high school, especially where I went and where I grew up, you operated very defensively about your emotions, because whatever it is that you felt that was a lever for someone else to pull, it was going to turn into, at best, a comedy bit. And at worst, some kind of bullying or coercion. So, like, the default state was any serious emotional information about you will be weaponized. So reveal nothing. You just perfect the blank mask. Perfect sort of like the neutral mask, and like just let everything roll off your back like water off of a duck. And again, it's just sort of like very much narrows the expression of gender and the emotional range that you're allowed to express. I lucked out in having some non-straight friends and eventually a girlfriend who I could actually talk to about something more with more depth and weight than the rules to Dungeons and Dragons. And eventually a couple of straight friends during that time who I could too, but that didn't come till like senior year. So it was like 3.5 years of high school before that, where it's like, okay, we'd do nothing. And then like sort of towards the end, as we all grew up just a little bit more, we were like, hey, maybe we can actually be human beings towards one another instead of faceless robots. But that faceless robot stance was a very effective and adaptive response to the social context we were put in. And it was forced not just by the guys, but also any girl you weren't dating.
Yeah, when I was younger, before I met you, I had a list of criteria for guys that I might theoretically date. And one of the requirements was that he had to have real friends. And it's especially ironic to listen to you be so deprecatory, if that's even a word, to your own friend network, because you literally had one of the tightest friend networks of any straight guy I encountered.
Right, but we're discounting my non-straight friends.
Yeah, for sure.
And so the thing that worked out there was I had non-straight friends.
Yeah, I was talking to an older guy about this recently, and I was saying, oh, you know, he was complaining about how, like, he always had male friends don't ever reach out to him. He has to do all the work. And I was like, well, aren't all your friends straight? And he was like, yeah. I was like, that's just kind of the fate of male friend networks. And he was like, well, I do all this work. I'm like, yeah, you're bisexual. He's like, damn it, that's true. And queer men are like the only ones who know how to be friends with men.
It is a challenge. And it is something that, like, again, once you've managed to get a straight guy to open up, it's something that you know, troubles them, because like there were these guys that they hung out with in high school who they felt like they were basically family with. And as soon as they're no longer in proximity because the sort of natural Brownian motion of their lives doesn't bring them into constant contact, their friendship just disappears.
Yep.
Because they don't know how to put in an effort to maintain a friendship. They don't know how to create and maintain those connections because they've had it, in some cases, literally beaten out of them.
So the big thing that we really came here to talk about, and we're way into the episode, but here we are, is the recent political shifts about men and women. And we're just seeing these staggering changes for young people in terms of politics, where girls have become, they are staying liberal. They haven't gotten a lot more liberal. They're staying more liberal, maybe getting a little bit more liberal. Boys have become much more conservative. Again, this is across developed countries. We're seeing this in the US, Germany, UK, France, like places that pretty different context politically. But it's happening all over. And, you know, I'm seeing numbers now that women ages 18 to 30 are anywhere from 50 to 30 points more liberal than men in their same age group in a lot of these countries. And this is the real kicker. Most of that chasm that has happened there occurred within just 6 years. So it happened in a pretty short period of time. And the same numbers are also coming back in America of like 45% of young men feel that men are discriminated against, which is a pretty high number of people, right? Especially if most of the people that you've talked to are not very sympathetic to your feelings of being discriminated against. So, Johnny, you've been complaining to me a fair bit recently that you feel like the algorithm with a capital A is trying to turn you into a woman-hating conservative. So can you talk a little bit more about that?
Oh, Jesus Christ. Yeah. Okay. So I'm reasonably media literate and sociologically literate for a layman guy. I understand that society is more complex than simply men have power or men are being discriminated against. Things are intersectional, and there are pockets of society where, or particular aspects of society where those power differentials get reversed, etc. So, like, I'll be on YouTube and I'll see a video discussing some actual concrete thing that negatively affects men. An easy example would be like a video on why men's life expectancy is shorter, or discussions about disproportionate custody awards in family court, or any of a dozen individual things that despite men's greater position of power in society, they're kind of losing out statistically somewhere. And I'll watch one of those videos and I'll see a perfectly well-reasoned, perfectly argument and position made by a perfectly reasonable person. And then YouTube decides, hey, this kind of male-centered content is what you want to see. And the next six videos I get suggested are like Andrew Tate and Jordan Peterson, right? And I can't, and once that started, you can't get them off your fucking feed. and I can see how if you approach
this. If you don't know, these are very conservative, like manosphere, which is like the really like creepy conservative man centric part of social media.
These are people who have made sexism their identity. Let's just go with that. Especially like Andrew Tate. At this point, I can't get them off of my like suggestions list. That's why they pop up, even though Andrew Tate's in fucking prison in Romania now. And I can absolutely see how if you encountered this experience with less well-formed ideas, not being married to a sociologist and therefore having sort of gathered a lot of background just by and not having strong positions and opinions yet formed yet to start with, you could sort of fall down this rabbit hole into this echo chamber and, you know, 6 months later emerge as a angry man who believes society is discriminating against him entirely and have come down on the side of, because you don't understand that the world is more complicated than men have power or women have power, that you've decided that the women have power because you've experienced these specific things that were negative for you about being a man, and no one came by and gave you your male privilege care package. And so you've decided that because this is your experience, this must be how the world works. and therefore you need to do something about it. And then you're out on the streets chanting anti-feminist hate slogans, all because you were socially isolated. Social media and its ilk are the only social contact you really engage in, and you didn't have any counterweight on the other side giving you the countervailing position.
What amazes me is that the movie Knives Out came out in 2019, so it must have been written in like late 2017 probably. And there's actually a bit in there where they're making fun of a young boy who's like turning into this far right, like conservative fascist little creep. And you can really just feel now like how the difference, right? Back then, we all laughed at that. We thought it was funny. And now here we are, like 5 years later, realizing, oh shit, it's not funny anymore. It's sad. It's really sad. And in general, we're just seeing social media replacing a lot of real human interaction for both young men and women. Most of the numbers I'm seeing say teenagers on average are spend 9 hours a day on social media, which, you know, suggests that quite a lot of them are on there a lot more than 9 hours a day.
That's the horrifying part.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, 9 hours is a lot. But it seems to have very different consequences for them gender-wise. So see big increases in girls' rates of self-harm across the social media era. But mostly just seems to drive boys to this extreme conservative right-wing political mentality.
I feel like that's by design, not necessarily by the social media companies themselves. Yeah. I feel like that there are specific groups that have gotten really good at weaponizing social media for propaganda.
Yeah.
And for social, if not social control, at least social disruption.
Yeah, so there's these communities that are online now that are taking the place of traditional real-life communities, face-to-face communities. They're fiercely conservative, but they're providing support and sympathy for young men who are showing up with these. They are legitimate complaints, right? That's the problem, is they are legitimate complaints, but then they get recontextualized and blown out of proportion. And
well, let's be fair. They have legitimate complaints. Not every complaint they have is legitimate.
There we go, for sure. But the thing is if you start with the complaint of, I would like a girlfriend, please, right? Like, you tend, especially as a young man, I think society is going to kind of mock you with that. Like, you get mocked a lot for that. And like, well, you have to earn it, blah, 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 blah. And people don't really, especially older people these days, do not appreciate how fucking hard it is to date as a young person. And so if no one around you has any real sympathy to offer, and the only people who do are these crazy people on the internet with their bullshit ideas, like, that's where you end up.
It's true.
You know, as we're sort of getting to the winding down portion of this, you know, I want to come back to traditional sociological theories of strain and anomie, which were originally developed to explain more about suicide with a reference to anomie and strain with reference to crime. But basically, they come down to the idea that if society puts a lot of pressure on you to achieve a certain goal in a certain way, but then makes it nearly impossible for you to do so, that it really fucks you up. And so the classical version of that was, you know, society says you're supposed to earn money and you're supposed to do it in this legal way. And then it turns out that for certain groups of people, it makes it really difficult for them to do so, right? And so therefore they end up turning to crime. And I think it's really helpful to conceptualize what's happening to a lot of young men these days in terms of those ideas of anomie and strain, which are always in sociological theory about feeling isolated, about conflict of norms, where you're feeling like the things that society is telling you to do is not the things that you're actually supposed to do. Of course, like you feel conflicted about how you're supposed to do things. And, you know, fundamentally, I think more than anything, it's that we've made the idea of being a good man just a phrase that no longer means anything.
Yeah. If you are, especially if you're trying to be liberal, if you're trying to be leftist and a good ally to women, to LGBTQ community, to people of racial identifications that might not be your own, and you are male, you can be good or you can be masculine, but you can't be both.
That's brutal, right? Like, it's so brutal. I don't feel like there's anywhere near this much ambivalence over the idea of what it means to be a good woman. Like, sure, there's a lot of possibilities there, but that doesn't mean that it's something that you have to feel ambivalent about.
We had a lot. We did for a while there. There was a thing where we had this thing where we had to have this cultural fight over this doesn't make you less of a woman. That doesn't make you less of a woman, right?
Yep.
We never really had that, or at least we never won that fight in terms of this doesn't make you less of a man. Mm-hmm. That doesn't make you less of a man. It doesn't make you less of a man to have emotions. So, like, we've been trying to have that fight to a certain degree as a culture, but we've been losing it.
Yeah, we still have a really heavy emphasis for men on physical strength and earning a lot of money. But perversely now, physical strength doesn't earn you much money these days. Like, it used to be that those things were things that went well together. And nowadays, they don't go particularly well together at all.
It's not just, it gets even stupider than that. Like, again, on the social media, I see lots of stupid social trends come and go. I spend a little more time in these spaces than you do, I think.
Not hard.
And one of the things I've noticed is this increasing trend of anything that a guy does that gives him small pleasures is less masculine. It's not new. The concept of a girly drink.
Yeah.
If
you're coming from a different culture, in America, at least, the phrase girly drink refers to alcoholic drinks that taste good.
Yeah.
Like, men are just only allowed to drink beer and
a straight whiskey. If they take that, shoot their whiskey straight, do a shot, grimace through it, and take what's next.
If you're a sophisticated man, I guess you're allowed to drink wine, but
wine is still a little...
It's a little bit on the borderline.
You know, you're supposed to basically approach whiskey the same way that women approach fine wine. Even if you step out of the realm of alcohol, if you order a sweet dessert coffee beverage, that's less manly. You're supposed to order, like, a black Americano. or just coffee, black.
Oh, also, interestingly enough, drink orders like that are also sized. So for women, if you order like a large like that, then like that's less feminine, which is so surreal.
But if you order a small, it's less masculine.
Less masculine,
You got to order the 20 ounces if you're a guy.
20 ounces of black coffee.
Yeah, it's a thing. Hobbies, having hobbies, even hobbies that only guys do.
Is less masculine.
Is less masculine. So like if you're if you have like minifigs, like the games like Warhammer or
figs being figurines,
etc. Like that involve like a lot of the little plastic figurines that you use as like little war games, right? Like by and large, those aren't hobbies that a lot of women engage in. They're very male dominated hobbies. But having those hobbies is also perceived to some degree as being less manly.
It's true. It's fucking insane.
It is bizarre and mind-boggling.
Yeah, I mean, we still have a fair bit of emphasis, too, on the idea of men as protectors and providers. But nowadays, you know, people having fewer and fewer children, men are extremely unlikely to be heavily involved in child-rearing. And, like, without wives and without children to take care of, like, what does that even mean anymore? Like, we've created a role that no longer has any context. We have so much masculine socialization that's about competition, violence, and antagonism. You know, one of the things that Johnny has said for years is that he feels like gender socialization towards men was always just geared into making them soldiers, and that we didn't stop doing that at the point where we weren't really fighting so many wars anymore.
You're right. Like, so the only emotion that it is manly to express are pride and anger.
Everything else gone.
Everything else, if you express that in a visible way, that is less manly.
Yeah, one of the old sociological findings, again, this has been true for years, is, for example, women are more angry than men, which is not what's generally perceived on a survey. But women also are happier than men. And when I usually would summarize that to my students and say, I'm not sure this any of this means what we think it means. Like, I think what it actually means is that women are allowed to have more feelings than men are. And just in general, like, you see women are sadder than men, women are happier than men, women are angrier than men. Women are just allowed to feel more in general.
I mean, we say women are sadder than men, but then there's that 80% of suicide statistic.
I know, and yet so many more women show up on studies as having mood disorders.
I think part of what's going on there is men are so socialized not to express or admit emotion that they will lie on a form.
I mean, that's definitely a real thing. Although at least one study on that one claimed that women lied on the form and claimed they were way less violent than they actually were when they were allowed to. There was a famous experiment that was really fun they did with people playing violent video games.
Yes.
Where, like, women were way less violent when someone was watching them play the video game than men were, but then when they told them they weren't being supervised, they were the same. Which was a fun finding from a long time ago. I don't know if it would still hold. But let's talk a little bit about what society could do about all of this, because this is a big set of problems that we've raised. There's a lot of conversations happening right now about putting limits on teenage access to social media, which is very difficult to set up, but the attorneys general in America, I think also the surgeon general, basically are trying to address it as a major public health crisis, and it is. We'll see what actually ends up happening about it.
I mean, we could also pass some laws restricting dangerous misinformation. Like, I'm not huge on restricting free speech overall, but, like, being able to shut down Russian troll farms at the very least is something I feel like we ought to be able to do.
One would think. Really having social campaigns that take the educational inequality between boys and girls very seriously would be helpful. Again, this is not something that is unique to America. This is throughout developed countries, and it happened at around the same time. And it's a big deal, but we've mostly not treated it as such. Like, we had a big campaign to try to make school more friendly for girls, and then in the process, unfortunately, we ended up making it a lot less friendly for boys. One of the things they talk about in the Reeves book and is the idea of changing when boys start school relative to girls, potentially. Someone else I was reading was talking about the idea that kindergarten needed to be changed, in America at least, in terms of what its expectations were, to try to even things out, although I'd be very curious to see how that compares in an international way. Related to that child thing, right? Just parenting that emphasizes boys' emotional intelligence and caretaking potential, whereas right now it's like, here, blow things up with your G.I. Joes and play with your science kit and build some Legos, yeah. Right? Like, there's nothing here about, here's how to take care of things and people. I've always had a whole big thing where I thought that both boys and girls should be given baby dolls and told to take care of them, but I don't know. It's never been a popular solution among most people I've talked to.
I think that would be a solution that would come later. I think you have to change the cultural conception of what masculinity is first.
Yeah, seems like it. I think we have to make space on the left for cishet men in a welcoming rather than a grudging way, which is one of the things that you had talked a lot about in these conversations that I think is really important.
Well, yeah. A good example of that I can talk about, or counterexample of that would be like when we on the left start talking about victims of sexual assault, those spaces immediately become women's spaces. And when men who have been the victims of sexual assault try to show up to those spaces, they are either grudgingly accepted at best or kind of shut out.
Sometimes they're actively shut out.
Or in communities actively shut out because the response is like, well, the women here don't feel comfortable with you here. You remind them of their assaulter and they don't feel safe with you here. And that's, I'm not trying to invalidate that, but that definitively places the comfort and safety of female victims of sexual assault above the safety and health and acceptance of male victims of sexual assault.
It's so deeply ingrained that I've actually literally had conversations with men who are themselves victims of sexual assault and will say so, and who I will then quote statistics at, which you can see in my book, about how common the experience of men's victimization as sexual assault is and relative to women, and they will still deny it. I'm like, but you yourself are a victim and you're denying this? Why? They're like, well, it just can't be real. I know too many women who are victims. I'm like, yes, but you know yourself. I think I think
the question at that point is, how many of the men that you know would tell you if they were victims?
Excellent question, and a very unfortunate one. But yeah, I will address that particular issue in great depth in a later episode when I start talking more about that book. In general, just trying to think about broader, more positive conceptions of masculinity that isn't by default conservative, and also recognizing that just as now we've given women multiple ways to be women
and more permission to be less feminine and not be seen as somehow lesser.
Right. That we need to broaden what it means to be masculine, to also like have that degree of flexibility and possibility to it, which again, I will also talk about more in another episode. But you, as an individual listening to this, may be saying, ah, those are lovely ideas, Julie, but what the fuck can I do? And so the biggest thing that I would encourage you to do, if you found the things that we're talking about today compelling, is to start challenging more of your own assumptions. Like, when you hear things, that your initial response to that is lack of sympathy, or to roll your eyes, or to reject, men's complaints. You know, like, sometimes, as you said, they're illegitimate complaints, right? Like, but to take a moment and say, okay, if that is an illegitimate complaint, where might it be coming from? Like, what's the source of that complaint? What's the reason for that? And also, why is my immediate response to that skepticism?
If someone's showing up with, like, a bonkers complaint about gender, they could just have a bonkers idea, but also maybe stop and wonder why they feel sufficiently put upon that this is what they've come up with.
Right. There's got to be something that's leading them to this feeling in the first place. And I hope we've tried to paint some of the picture here for you as much as we can in this short episode about like where someone would be coming from there. Another thing that you can do personally is try to be cognizant of the way you interact with boy and girl children. Like, a lot of times people interact with boys and girls very differently. And so, like, really paying attention to the way that you interact with them. I think as a culture, we learned to be very careful about the way we interacted with girls. We didn't learn to be careful about the way we interact with boys. And we desperately need to be careful about the way that we interact with boys. Not just to like teach them to be careful, which is what I see some liberal parents doing, right? Like, oh, it's very important for me to teach my son about consent. Yes, that's true. But you also need to teach your son about what it means to take care of people.
You also need to teach your son to express their emotions and not bury them.
Cute little feelings charts that some of my friends have in their houses for their kids that I think are so adorable and now have become so popular with my neurodivergent peeps.
Oh, those are so good for the neurodivergent peeps.
It's like trying to teach you how to express your feelings. And like, I generally see the parents of my friends with daughters doing a better job of this than they are with their sons. And so being cognizant of, like, how much time am I spending talking to my son about his feelings? Like, that's a thing that matters. And then make space in your life and conversation for men to complain about things that bother them without dismissing their complaints as trivial or invalid at first glance, right? Like, there's got to be space for men to come to liberal spaces and say, hey, this is how it feels to be me. Without having everyone around them go, we don't care.
It's important that if you want to keep liberal men on the left and be able to enculturate new ones, that they be more than just soldiers for the left, right? They have to be fully fledged members of this movement who are going to see their lives advance the same way that everyone else is, and they're going to see the benefits of a more liberal society the same way that everyone else is, rather than simply expected to be like, oh, well, you are part of the class of people that have power, regardless of how much individual power that you have. Therefore, you don't deserve any of the community here. You're just here to provide it.
Yeah. I will say here towards the end of the episode that this has been a whole series of issues that I have been campaigning for very adamantly my entire career. I regularly will do things like be the discussant at a gender studies panel and stand up and say, like, hey, let's look around the room. Like, where are the straight men here? And, you know, like, whose perspective are we actually theorizing and talking about here? And I usually am the only person in the room who gives a shit. And I noticed that, right? Like, that this has become my job, that has always been my job, to be the woman in the room who stands up and says, but where are the straight men? Where are the straight cis men? Like, what are we actually accomplishing in terms of our understanding of gender, in terms of our understanding of political theorizing about gender, if the only people who are contributing to that are a bunch of upper middle class, mostly white women, and, you know, some queers of varying genders, still, again, mostly white. And I think that has trickled down, like that academic discourse has really trickled down into the popular discourse a lot. And I am very passionate about trying to change it. I realize that I might not have been successful in persuading you here in an hour, but I hope I've at least given you some food for thought. I'll be talking about some of these issues a lot more in subsequent episodes. I promise that I'm not going to dwell on politics all the time, because I think even in a state of political upheaval that we all deserve to still have fun and some rest, including me. So this is kind of going to be a break where I'm just going to be like way more political than I usually am. I'm going to try to return to something a little bit sexier with my next episode. But thank you for listening, and I really hope that you will take the time to investigate some of the things that I'm talking about if it's new information for you.
Thanks for listening, and maybe at some point I'll have a YouTube channel to show on here.